I, Clinton Stark from Stark Insider. I'm joined today with a special guest, film director Jeffrey Goodman, who is dialing in from Shreveport, Louisiana. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hey, Clint. How you doing?
Doing great. Thanks for taking some time out of your really busy schedule to spend some time with us.
Oh, always awesome to speak with you.
So we last met in San Jose when you were screening your last film, The Last Lullaby. So what I'd like to do is spend some time talking about The Lullaby, or Lullaby, I should say, then talk about your new film project, Peril, and then finally, because I think I've called you Director 2.0, because you really do use social media and to work on your projects, so I wouldn't mind spending some time on that as well.
Sure.
Okay, so Lullaby is a film that I saw last year at Camera Cinema in San Jose. It was a Sunday morning. I'll never forget because my expectations, to be honest, were low. I mean, I hadn't heard of the film, and I went in there, and I was blown away. You know, I love the film, The Last Lullaby, starring Tom Sizemore and Sasha Alexander. And, of course, you were at the screening, and that's how we met afterwards. And so that was... And then, of course, I think you'd shown that at Cinequest Film Festival. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, I showed in Cinequest 2009. I guess in February of 2009, early March 2009, and then I was back for the Camera Cinema Club. I think that was in May of 2009.
And so, let's talk about where that project is now. I mean, the film, when I saw it, you were looking for distribution. Can you give us an update on where that stands now?
Sure. So we did a film festival run with The Last Lullaby. We went to 19 film festivals in all, starting in late March of 2008. And then at the beginning of 2009, I announced to my investors that I was going to self-distribute Lullaby theatrically. And I didn't know if that was going to last 1 week, 50 weeks. I had no idea how long it would go, but I said I would keep doing it as long as we weren't losing money each week. And so we ended up doing a 10-week theatrical run beginning May 1st of 2009. We went to select cities. We went to San Jose. We went to three cities in Iowa because Max Allen Collins, one of the two writers and the creator of the graphic novel The Road to Perdition that became the movie with Tom Hanks and Paul Newman, Max is from Iowa. And so we did three different cities in Iowa with Max in attendance at all three cities. We did three cities in Louisiana, which is where I live. We did a city in Florida, and that may be it. And that ended probably in late July, early August of 2009. Simultaneously, we brought what's called a foreign sales company on board to represent the film. Basically, a foreign sales company is who sells your film to distributors outside of America. So we brought them on, I think, right around May of 2009. It's a company called Cinema Vault out of Canada, and they've been representing the film since they premiered the film in terms of foreign buyers. They premiered it at the Cannes Film Market in May of 2009, and then they've been taking it to other markets since then. There's just so people know, there's three major film markets every year. There's one in February as part of the Berlin Film Festival. It's called the European Film Market. And then there's one in May as part of the Cannes Film Festival. It's simply called the Cannes Film Market. And then there's one in November in Los Angeles as part of AFI Film Festival, and it's called the American Film Market. And they're basically these huge trade shows where these companies set up booths. They each represent a certain amount of films, and foreign distributors are there in attendance to acquire product. And so this company has been doing this with Lullaby since May of 2009. I think we've sold the film in about 11 or 12 different foreign territories. And then in January of this year, we brought on what's called a domestic sales rep, and basically what that person does is represent the film to U.S. buyers, and primarily in our situation to U.S. cable television and DVD buyers. And so he's been pitching the film since January. We haven't made a deal yet on the cable TV and DVD front in America, but we will. We just haven't yet. And that's kind of where things stand. That's sort of the last piece of the puzzle. I mean, what I tell the investors is once we make a deal for U.S. cable rights, U.S. DVD rights, and probably U.S. digital rights, you know, then the film, I mean, we'll plug it here and there periodically, but then the film will kind of be placed and positioned in all the places that you can place and position a film. And, you know, we will just hope that people continue to find it and discover it.
So if people want to see The Last Lullaby right now, can or if they do, where do they go to see it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, right now we've got it available as a first-run DVD off the film's website, which is www.thelastlullaby.com. That's a DVD that I put together, actually. I mean, it's a high-quality DVD, but there's no extras, there's no bells and whistles. And if you go to the film's website, www.thelastlullaby.com, right on the homepage at the very top, you'll see a link to purchase. And that's the best way to see the movie right now.
And we should add, of course, we're talking about independent film here. You're not working for a major studio. You've gone and raised all this funding yourself, put the business plan together, basically assembled the entire operation, I believe, and you've spent, I think last time you told me, Jeffrey, the better part of 7 years, 8 years of your life doing this so far?
Yeah, that's about right. I mean, you know, kind of exclusively on Lullaby, let's say 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, about 6, 6.5 years, a very long time, yeah.
No kidding, because it really opens my eyes to how much effort and hard work goes into bringing a film to the big screen. It's really quite something.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, I think most people, I mean, if you're not a filmmaker, if you're not directly involved in filmmaking, I think for most people it is eye-opening and quite surprising just all that it takes to kind of put together a full-length film.
Now you were the director, so but it seems to me like you were very hands-on in all the aspects of the business, you know, from the business plan to the casting and so forth. Is that something that a director normally does?
You know, I mean, I really was a producer, not the producer, because I had a producer also, but I was really a producer and the director of The Last Lullaby in that I got the rights to the film, I raised all the money for the film, and then once all the money was in place, I brought a producer on board. You know, every situation is different. You know, some directors are kind of born into it. Some directors get there by acting first. Some directors get there by writing themselves into the opportunity. For me, you know, I kind of said, well, I was going to get there by creating the opportunity for myself and raise the money so that I could direct my first feature. And I've always felt that, yeah, at least in being a director, the single hardest step is making your first full-length film, because basically, you know, it usually takes a fairly substantial amount of money to make a full-length film, and you've got to go out there and convince people to give you money for something that technically you've never done before. I mean, I had made 6 short films before The Last Lullaby, but I'd never made a full-length film, so it's always going to be a challenge, I think, for every director to direct their first full-length film, and it's just trying to figure out what's the best path for yourself to get there. And for me, it just seemed like trying to raise the money myself.
All right, great. Let's talk about, because I guess one of the things of making your first feature is now you've learned a lot. You've probably made many mistakes, I'm sure, and you've done many things very well. And so the combination of your experience now helps you on your next project, I'm assuming. And that is Peril, P-E-R-I-L. That's the film I guess you've been working on since last year, or maybe even longer. Why don't you tell us about that project?
Sure. You know, Peril is a project. I guess somewhat different thing about me. I mean, there are other people like this, but I'm a director who doesn't write. I really don't believe I've got great talents as a writer, and so I'm always looking for people to collaborate with in terms of writers. And so on The Last Lullaby, I had 2 writers, Max Allen Collins, who I spoke about earlier, and then a gentleman by the name of Peter Began. And Peter, this is an original screenplay, Peril is, whereas The Last Lullaby was based on a existing short story. This is Peril is an original screenplay by Peter Began. I raised money about a year and a half ago to develop the project, to pay Peter to write the script, and now the first draft, or let's say early draft of the film is written, and now I'm raising the remainder of the money to make the movie. Peril, I tell people, I mean, maybe I kind of made up this term, but, you know, peril's part of the young boy in peril type genre. And I tell people, you know, think of films like Witness or The Client. The whole movie revolves around this 11-year-old boy who finds out something he's not supposed to know and people come after him. And it's that kind of movie.
And so where are you in the process? Have you cast the film yet?
No, I'm doing the same exact thing I did with The Last Lullaby, which is I'm raising all the money first, and then I'll start approaching actors and start choosing locations. So right now, you know, 99% of my time right now is going towards raising the money for Peril. So you know, I had 49 investors in all for The Last Lullaby. I'm not sure how many I'll have for Peril. I mean, things are going well. But when you're raising money for a film the way that I put them together, you just never know how long that process is going to take. I mean, I could be done raising all the money in 2 weeks, or it could be 6 months from now, or anywhere in between. So every day I'm trying to get in front of a certain number of people and to talk about the film, and just focused on raising the money for it right now.
So, you know, and I'm sure it's the economy obviously is probably not helping that process, but when you go to raise funds for a film, and I think we've talked about this before, because I love the business aspects of film too. I think it's very challenging, but and sometimes very complicated. When you go to raise the funds, are you going out there with a specific number in mind? Or at some point, if you get less, or maybe you even get more than you wanted, do you then adjust, you know, your entire project based on the funding you get?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I've got a fairly substantial, what they call a PPM, a private placement memorandum, and which is basically a business plan. And you know, I have a target number specified in the business plan. And right now, I'm trying to raise. And I did the same thing with The Last Lullaby. I raised money in units. So with The Last Lullaby, I was trying to raise 40 units at $50,000 each. I was trying to raise $2 million. And I've got Peril structured in units as well. And, you know, I'm trying to raise an exact number. But I do say in the operating agreement, because I set up an LLC to make these films, and it's a new LLC for Peril than it was for Lullaby. And I say in the operating agreements that govern the LLC that I've got until a certain amount of time to raise at least half the money. If I don't raise at least half the money by this date, and I think it's December 31st of 2011, then all the investors get their money back plus the interest that's earned in escrow. So as I'm raising money right now and investors say, yes, I'm in, I want to participate, they actually write me a check and it goes and sits in an escrow account that my attorney has set up. But I also say in the operating agreement that if I succeed in raising at least a half but less than a whole, I do reserve the right to go ahead and make the movie at that reduced rate. So, you know, that way I don't get 80-90% of the way there and then have to give the investors all their money back. But I do, I mean, I am confident. I raised all the money I was trying to raise for Lullaby, and it also didn't take me a year and a half to do it. It only took me about 10 months. So, you know, I'm confident I'll raise all the money I'm trying to raise for Peril, and I'm also confident I'll do it well before the end of 2011. But, you know, those are just protections that are built in there for both the investors and for me.
So let's talk about the creative side a little bit. I mean, you've done Lullaby, which was, now I always get this wrong, the genre, you know, would you call it a film noir, or is there a better term for that?
No, I mean, everyone likes to call it that, so that's fine. I mean, it's always been a genre I'm a huge fan of. You know, it's certainly got some film noir
elements,
tone, and some film noir elements. You know, it's also got crime elements, crime drama.
That's right.
So, you know, I'll take all of those.
Okay. And then Peril, is the style of Peril going to be different? Well, it sounds just by the nature of the story that it would be, but there is some similar element. Would the style be similar, or are you doing something different?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, it's and I'm not sure I've fully fleshed that out yet. I mean, I'm watching a lot of movies right now to kind of remain creatively stimulated and inspired, and I'm taking some notes just on, you know, hey, I'd like to go back and check that out in terms of the way they use sound or the way they use the camera. But you know, I haven't fully pinpointed sort of what the style will be. And you know, I think it's kind of, for better or for worse, it's kind of self-protecting in a way, because I feel like if I get too attached to thinking about the creative apparel, I'll get frustrated with mm-hmm. with raising the money, because I'll just be so ready to make it. So yeah. and not allowing myself to go there too much right now, I think it allows me to sort of focus on what I need to be focused on primarily, which is raising the money, and it allows me to be patient in this process too.
And when you obviously, I mean, you watch a lot of films, and I see you talk about it on Facebook and so forth. That has a direct influence on your filmmaking style. When you watch a film, and you mentioned, you know, maybe it's the sound, maybe it's the way they're using the camera. Do you look for specific techniques and say, "Hey, I like that. I'm going to try that in my film"?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I'm always looking, you know, I'm always looking to be inspired. And, you know, sometimes it comes in the form of a movie from 1940 and I pick up something that, wow, I've never seen one do that before. You know, I want to see if there's a place to implement that on this new film. And sometimes it comes in the form of something very new, you know, a film from 2008, 2009, because, you know, I don't want to be so far removed from the present. I mean, I want to understand kind of what the cutting edge techniques are, what people of my generation are doing. But at the same time, I think there's some, you know, wonderful stuff that happened 50, 60, 70 years ago.
Is there, let's talk about some maybe recent films you've seen or, you know, that really you like, and can you give us share some of those titles? And,
I'm sort of gonna go against what I just said. I really don't watch a lot of new movies, unfortunately. Just because I've gotten inspired recently in the last year, really between the last time we talked and now, I've really gotten into kind of. There's a whole community, let's say, in the blogosphere that's very serious about film history, very serious about talking about movies, and I've kind of become part of that community in the last year, and it's really been one of my greatest sort of hobbies and new connections, because it, you know, a lot of times, I mean, I've always been in, since I started on this path, I've been into movies from the 20s or 30s or movies from France or from the Middle East, but you know, it can be a very lonely pursuit, particularly when you don't have anyone to discuss those movies with. So I found this community that can actually, you know, share those experiences with, which has been very fulfilling and satisfying. All that to say, I mean, at the beginning of this year, I put together a list on my blog, which I called, you know, it's my favorite film from each year from 1926 to 2008.
Cool.
And I chose a film for each year, and then I talked about why that I chose that film. And then I also, in each of those posts, I talked about movies that I hadn't yet seen from those years that I still wanted to see. So that took me about 4 months. I think I did a post a day for each year, and that took me about 3 or 4 months to put together. And then once I put that together, my big focus became going back and seeing those movies that I mentioned I hadn't seen before. And I started at 1926, and I've kind of been running through that in order. And so I think I'm at 1945, 1946 right now. And primarily everything I'm seeing is sort of from that period. But, you know, some movies I've seen recently, I saw this movie called The Seventh Victim, which it's kind of it's got a big reputation, but, you know, it's got a big reputation within a certain population. I mean, it was made in the 40s. It's a low-budget horror film, but produced by this guy, Val Lewton, who's considered, you know, maybe the greatest low-budget horror producer of all time. And then I saw John Ford film, the famous Western director, called A Long Voyage Home, which I really, really liked recently. So, I mean, those are a couple films that I've seen in the last couple months. I mean, things that I'd never seen before that just really did it for me.
Yeah, I'm a big horror fan. Have you seen Dario Argento, any of his works?
You know, I really...
His acquired taste.
No, I really, I hate to admit it, but I don't know Argento's work well at all. I mean, obviously I know him by reputation, and I have certain friends in that community who are huge Argento fans, but horror is not a genre that I know as well as I should. So yeah. Argento, there's some Argento films like Suspiria and stuff like that.
That's a classic.
Yeah, that I've never seen, but they're kind of on that list of gaps to fill in as I move through this.
Yeah, he tells his stories primarily through style, I would say. Over a little bit of substance, but I love them. Have you seen Avatar?
Yeah, I did see Avatar.
What'd you think?
I enjoyed it. I saw it 3D. I saw it probably a week after it came out. I saw it in the theater. I think I enjoyed it more than anything just for I felt like the 3D experience was unlike anything else I'd ever had. I really feel like Cameron did use 3D in a fairly new way. I mean, I heard him speak, I think, on Charlie Rose right around that time, and he was talking about, you know, how 3D, historically people have thought about 3D as kind of throwing things at you. And he wanted to sort of create an effect where he brought you in rather than threw things at you. And I felt like he really achieved that. I mean, there was something different, something magnetic in my experience of watching the film, unlike anything I've ever had really at the cinema. And so, you know, I appreciated its ingenuity in that respect. What I don't hope for is that, you know, all of a sudden, you know, everyone's making 3D movies, because
exactly.
I think there are very few people that are as capable and talented at using that technique as Cameron is.
Yeah, and of course Hollywood's looking for, you know, the next big cash cow, and sure enough, all these 2D, 3D conversion houses popped up, you know, cottage industry. And
yeah.
Just converting everything in sight into 3D.
Right. Yeah. It's that part scares me a little bit. But, you know, and a lot of people in my world would say, oh, I hate Avatar, it's a sellout. I don't know, you know, what the big deal is. But, you know, I honestly appreciated it.
So with that, let's segue, because I do know you talked about the films you've been watching. You talked about the list you put together from 1926. People can follow along. Social media, you know, Facebook and Twitter, and you seem very, very engaged in this. And I've seen you on there because I've been following you for, I guess, over a year. And I see you doing, you know, quizzes, you talk about films, you do podcast updates, and you've added transparency to the whole process of filmmaking, which I think is what social media does, right? It adds transparency, it adds a direct engagement with either it's a customer or, in this case, I guess, fans and colleagues. So talk about that a little bit. What is it that you're trying to achieve with your use of social media?
Well, I want to say one thing. I mean, this kind of answers the question. I mean, one thing there's a film critic I've always liked, and her name is Pauline Kael. She's no longer with us, but she was a critic for The New Yorker from, I think, 1967 till I believe early 2000 or something like that. Maybe she stopped a little bit earlier than that. But anyway, she had a bunch of famous essays back in the day when New Yorker would allow her, give her as many as 7, 8, 9, 10 pages to go off. And I remember one article she was writing right at the time of maybe the last major movement in American cinema, what they call the New Hollywood or the American New Wave. I mean, that was a period in Hollywood from 1967 till let's say 1976, 1977. I mean, just a great period of movies. You know, that's when we had the Godfather movies, Chinatown,
French Connection,
Jaws, the French Connection, yeah, Five Easy Pieces, Bonnie and Clyde, The Wild Bunch. I mean, just a great period for American cinema. And she made a comment in one of her essays, I don't know which one it was at this point, but she said something like, you know, for movies really to change, you know, it kind of relies on three separate parties. You know, the money people, the financiers, the producers all of a sudden have to want to support a different kind of movie. The critics have to all of a sudden, you know, get behind a certain kind of cinema. And then the audiences, you know, third off, you know, the audiences all of a sudden have to demand kind of a certain level of product and a different quality of product. And, you know, I think that's been part of that final piece, that third piece, the audience, has been some of my motivation, I think, in starting the daily trivia contest on Facebook, and some of my more cinephile-based postings has just been trying to kind of continue to maybe educate and cultivate an audience that wants a different kind of product, and hopefully expose them to films they wouldn't be exposed to otherwise. And just I feel like at times we're so pounded by Hollywood that many people, that's the only kind of film they think of anymore. And I want to be a voice that's somewhat counter to that. I mean, I like Hollywood products sometimes, but also want to let people know that this is a 100-year plus year old medium, and there are other things worth seeing. And I want to kind of be hopefully a part of growing that audience, and maybe maybe they'll continue to sort of yearn for other kinds of films and not only one kind of product. So I mean, that's one of my motivations. And I mean, the other thing is I just feel like the filmmaking is changing. I mean, I don't even know if I can articulate all this, but I mean, I do feel like, creators in this day and age, whether it's a musician, a filmmaker, a painter, a writer, I mean, in the way that things are going, and you've gotta have more interaction with your audience. There are very few distributors of any product in this day and age that are kind of cultivating that audience for you. So you as a creator have to be not only the person creating the product, but you also have to be the person engaged with the audience that is consuming your product.
Right. So and I completely agree. I think it's not just with film, it's with just about any industry where there's a direct connection between the person creating the product and the people consuming it. And then in some ways, it's almost not like a creator and consumer. It's becoming a community kind of process. And so if someone, for example, said something on Facebook or Twitter, and are you looking to take input on, and would that perhaps influence or change the way you think about something like Peril?
I mean, I don't think I would ever, and I mean, there are certain camps out there that think this is exactly what you need to do, and I'm wrong in saying what I'm about to say, but I personally don't think it's creatively healthy for me to, put the whole script on of Peril online and say, hey, what do you guys think? I want to hear all your input right before I make this. Just because, it's as a creative for me, at least at this stage in my career, I mean, I'm someone who I have to hear myself. And once you get too many voices into the conversation, it gets to be very difficult to hear yourself. And I mean, that's my fear, and I could be wrong in that respect. I mean, I know there are people that feel like, you've got to involve the community, not only, take them through the journey, but also allow them to participate in the creation of it. But, that second part of it, I don't know. I haven't found the happy medium, at least in my own space yet.
Yeah, I think, there's a limit to crowdsourcing, I guess they may call it, and especially the creative process, like you say. I think, you eventually dilute it and get the lowest common denominator. I mean, sometimes in a creative environment, less is more, right? So.
Yeah, I feel that way, and, I'm somewhat in the minority, I think, with that. I mean, at least in a lot of the articles I'm reading, a lot of the people I'm following, I mean, a lot of people don't agree with me there, but, I'm just thinking about my own self and thinking about how how I feel like I create, and that aspect of it, allowing too much interaction doesn't seem like a healthy way for me.
So if people want to follow you, get updates, why don't you kind of give out, well, we can put the links in the post as well, but where should people go to find out more?
Sure. I'm really excited, and I've been very proactive with that blog I mentioned earlier, which it's not the easiest blog to find, but it's called Cahier Positif, which is CAHIERSPOSITIF. But the easiest way to find it really is to just go to the Last Lullaby website, www.lastlullaby.com, and you'll see a link to my blog right there on the homepage, and that's the best way to find it. That's a great place. I have fan pages for both The Last Lullaby and Peril on Facebook, and then I'm also on Twitter. You can find me on Twitter at Chaio Films, which is the name of my production company. It's Chaiollot Films. And I think those are the primary places that I'm interacting. And I really am using social media, I think, every day now. I mean, it's I mentioned I'm doing a daily movie, a trivia game over at the Peril fan page on Facebook. I'm trying to write on the blog almost every day, too.
Are you, it sounds like you're really busy with that stuff. Are you also touring anytime soon, or are you just really focused right now, it sounds like, on the financing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really focused on the financing. I mean, I'm giving talks here and there. I gave a talk last Monday. I gave a talk the Saturday before that. So occasionally, people will ask me to come speak. But 99% of my time is focused on raising money for Peril because I'm kind of a one-man gang when it comes to that part of the process. And, it's like this thing that doesn't move at all unless I'm there pushing it. And so, I'm ready. I think it's time for me to make another film. And that's only going to happen if I can go get the money for it. So I feel like that's where my priorities need to be.
Very exciting. So, well, thanks very much, Jeffrey, for taking some time with Stark Insider, being our first guest, our first podcast on the new site. I appreciate it. It's always been a great conversation when you're on the phone with us.
Oh, awesome, Clint. No, I always love speaking with y'all. And I mean, you guys have been amazingly supportive. And, I look forward to staying in touch through the years on all of this and doing another one in person here soon.
We will. Next time you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, drop us a note. And we look forward to hearing the next chapter in Peril and many more after that, I'm sure. So thanks.
Awesome.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Special guest today, Jeffrey Goodman, film director, The Last Lullaby, now working on a new project called Peril. This is Clinton Stark, Stark Insider. Thanks for joining us. Bye, everyone.